A new defense alliance is emerging, one that will shake the world. What does Europe do after America? Europe's pretty capable militarily. It has nuclear weapons. It has modern technology. There's a lot of countries with modern militaries. But so many things are organized as part of NATO that is built on the foundation of the US. But if Europe can't rely on Donald Trump's America, what can it do to protect itself? We're going to look at the new answer that they've come up with and Britain's role in it on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. The After America European Alliance looks like this. Britain and France provide nuclear weapons. Germany provides the biggest spending military and the most expensive conventional military. That's what's been emerging from a series of important meetings over the last few weeks. French President Emmanuel Macron traveled to Britain, where he had the red carpet rolled out for him in a big state visit. Friedrich Merz recently traveled to the UK and sat down and talked to the British Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, and they signed a new defence alliance. This is a major geopolitical shift. And to talk about it, I'm joined today by Joshua Michels. Joshua, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
Probably what stands out the most from these last few weeks is something that replaces NATO, where all of these different countries in NATO have a self-defense clause. If one country in NATO is attacked, in theory, everybody in NATO should come to their defense. We're now seeing Britain and Germany sit down and sign their own treaty with their own self-defense clause, which is completely redundant if you trust NATO, but you're starting to see people build relationships, build alliances outside of NATO so they can have this military relationship independent of the United States. Can you summarize for us some of the major developments in the development of this new military alliance?
Yes. So the important backdrop, as you have pointed out, is the United States vacuum that's being created. And we have to remember that after World War II, America has stationed troops in Germany, and many of those troops are still in Germany. And shortly after World War II, America also stationed nuclear weapons in Germany. And some of this was, a big reason was that Germany would not have to defend itself so that they would not develop their own independent military capabilities. At a time, the Soviet Union was a threat to Germany. And now we have more and more talks where Germany is talking about getting their own nuclear weapons, but the most German politicians are not comfortable with saying that. So instead, they're working with France and with Britain about having a nuclear European umbrella, and that's obviously in case the American nuclear umbrella fails. And then another thing, as you alluded to, was that they independently of NATO agree that if one is attacked, we will defend ourselves together.
So you've had a series of articles recently on all the different ways that Britain is depending on Germany. And I think one part of NATO that would need replacing is NATO's reliance on America's defense industry. Like, you've got all of these different defense companies. America has huge, very valuable defense companies. We're seeing German defense companies now take on more and more of a leading role within Europe. There are, of course, other very significant defense companies. There are significant British defense companies. But German defense companies, and especially Rheinmetall, have been doing more and more partnerships with other companies and becoming more and more of a part of Britain's defense industry. You wrote on that recently. What can you tell us about that trend?
Yes, that's right. So unlike the United States, Europe has a very diverse defense corporations, and they have to cooperate with the different countries because each country obviously has their own defense industry. But as you say, there are more and more corporations going on. And for example, Rheinmetall set up their own factories in 2009 in the UK with the stated goal to provide the UK with some of their defense capabilities. Not the UK allowed that. The government has to agree to things like that, and was a rather small beginning. But then in 2019, for example, BAE sold 55% of their shares of their land division. So it's not the whole entire company, but their land division, which Rheinmetall is focusing on, to Rheinmetall, basically to Germany. Now, at the time, Britain, and that's an important trend to consider, was saying that BAE is a bit too powerful. We have to balance this out a little bit. And that's a bit of saying, like, we had a powerful British Empire, but we're not proud of it. We want to not be seen as the major player in the world anymore. We want to diversify and things like that. But then at the same time, Germany is doing the opposite. They are saying Rheinmetall needs to become stronger and be the dominant force in Europe. So you have to see those opposite trends, where Britain says, like, well, we don't want to be seen as the opposite one, and Germany doesn't want to be seen as the dominant one either, but they are pushing in that way more in a secretive manner. So Rheinmetall went in there and set himself up, and they have been providing the Boxer tanks and the Challenger 3 tanks, which is like a powerful main battle tank, which is like critical for any ground invasion to defend itself against. So that's some critical defense equipment right there. And that's some of the backdrop where we're coming now to. Now, after Donald Trump has been reelected and all these things, people are more frightened that they will have to do more in cooperating together in light of Russia's attack on Ukraine, but also their cooperation with China. So there are some big Asian powers coming together, and Europe doesn't want to look fragmented. For more than a decade, they have been working to being established in the UK. Now they are looking at expanding that through government treaties. And part of that government treaties was, for example, that Rheinmetall will build another factory, and they said for the first time in 10 years, they're building like those cannons for tanks or something like that. I don't quite remember. But it was like another critical structure that Britain did not have. They gave it up because they were like, we don't need it. We don't want to be that big empire anymore. So they gave up that factory. But now Rheinmetall is in there, and they are building it for the British defense industry. And we can even see that on a larger scale. You had an article about talking about the military bases. Like, Germany is building a military base to be the deterrent in Europe, and Britain is basically retreating from the military scene. And now we have this new agreement that they just signed.
Maybe if we can 17. Just stick with the say Rheinmetall and the defense industry before we get into some of those other agreements, because I think it is important to note, like, there are sound military reasons for the nations in Europe to come together and agree on this. If you the European Union has about 1.5 million active duty military personnel, and I think that figure is a few years old. It includes the UK, but it's a good ballpark figure. US is about 1.3, 1.4 million active duty military personnel, like roughly the same size. Those figures are not directly comparable. They're from slightly different sources, counting in different ways. But ballpark figure, they're about the same size. One massive difference and that is in America's favor is, for America, those 1.5 million personnel are using the same tanks and the same guns. You know, obviously, America, they're slightly different tanks for different roles, different guns for different roles, but that's the general idea. Europe, they've got they've got a dozen or more different main battle tanks. Like, everybody's doing their nation's guns and their nation's tanks. And it means that that's much less effective. If you pour a lot of effort into research and development to make the most modern tank, and then you use just that one design across a military of 1.5 million people, the cost per tank over that research and development is going to be a lot lower. Whereas for Europe, they can't afford to put as much money into research and development because, well, that's just going to only be used by the Italian army or the German army or the French army or the British army. And so what a lot of these countries are saying is, well, we need to come together. We need to have a European main battle tank rather than just a German or a British main battle tank. And they've been more successful in some areas than others. Nations do want to have their own champions. But this is a core thing that Germany is quote unquote solving. And yeah, there are advantages to France or even Britain to coming together as part of this. Realistically, it's choices depending on America or Germany. And it's gone in the German direction. And all of Europe is increasingly going in this direction.
Yes, and that is also part of it, where they're saying like we have to cooperate on, for example, precision missile defense systems. And that's something that is very interesting in relation to history too. Like in World War II, Germany built missiles to strike London, and they did strike London. Those were the first missiles that flew over the English Channel. But now, and they were called V-weapons, Vergeltungswaffe, or vengeance weapons, because Britain bombed some of Germany's cities, because Germany obviously tried to invade and conquer Britain. So this is some of the context. So they're working together on a defense agreement that involves technology that was first used in an attack on Britain. And they're also working together on a new submarine factory. In this time of age, these submarines don't have any humans in them. They are unmanned drone submarines, and they are meant to basically survey the whole water and detect different kind of ships, submarines, tankers, merchant ships, down to their different classes, to be able to determine who is threatening the undersea cables or threatening the merchant ships. And it's a German startup called Helsing that is now building a factory under the new agreement in Britain. And part of that factory, it's called a resilience factory, because it's building the artificial intelligence structure in Britain to be able to have that whole surveillance system underwater, to be then able to determine all the threats in the sea, so that those German submarines will be during English waters and all around, detecting who is friend and who is foe. And if you study again World War II history, like, it's one of the most critical parts to know where your enemy is, that you can strike them, that you can be prepared for an attack. So if Britain ends up saying we are relying on those German submarines to see our threat and to let them know where we are, then you have a very dangerous situation that could end up leading to Britain easily being betrayed by their World War II foe.
And I want to pick up on this point a bit later of Britain. Should Britain rely on its World War II enemy? I mean, it's been 80 years or more. Like, what's the big deal? I do want to address that later. But just to keep going and giving an overview of this emerging defense relationship, Germany provides a lot of the defense companies, a lot of the defense tech. Germany now by far is the largest military spender within Europe. It's overtaken France, and that gap just continues and I think even widens as you look at budget projections going out over the next several years. Germany has the low debt that enables them to borrow and spend a lot on their military in a way that France just can't. You've got, as you alluded to, the first German permanent overseas base or a foreign military base in Lithuania, as they're getting all of Europe to kind of look to them in the way that they once looked to America. So Germany is getting ready to provide a lot of conventional military muscle. You also bring to that the way that the Dutch army has been absorbed into the German army, significant chunks of the Czech army. You've got entire tank brigades from Czechia or the Czech Republic, I think Romania as well, absorbed into the German army. They really are preparing to play this role as the pillar conventional military of Europe. Meanwhile, what Britain largely brings to the table, still a strong conventional military, a strong navy. Britain has aircraft carriers, Germany doesn't. And there's a very strong naval tradition there. But really what a lot of the discussion is focused on is nuclear power. And we're seeing Britain and France work together to coordinate their military power. And then Germany has expressed an interest in sharing that. And I think that's where all of these leaders are very clearly driving, even if they haven't announced it yet. What's the situation on nuclear cooperation?
So Germany does have US nuclear weapons on ground, and it has US and it has ordered F-35s capable of delivering those nuclear weapons. It already has their own Tornado fleet that it's capable, but they are getting outdated. And as you alluded to, there's a cooperation between different European countries on the future combat air system when it comes to building their own fighter jet. But since that fighter jet is not developed yet because they were in fightings, they are ordering the F-35s as a bridge to their own common fighter jet. So Germany has the fighter jets to deliver the weapons, and they have the nuclear weapons of America. They also have nuclear-capable submarines, but they don't have any nukes for those submarines. They also don't have any nukes for missiles. So the only thing they have access to technically is those fighter jets with the nuclear weapons, which is a deterrent, obviously, but it's dependent on the United States. France has their own nuclear arsenal, and Britain has their own nuclear arsenal, for example, with their submarines. And that gives them their deterrence. So if not in talks, can we have the European umbrella saying, like, can we share those weapons that at one point France would be able to say, we are responding to a nuclear threat, and anyone attacking Europe will have to face a nuclear attack from France, a counter strike. Now you could also say, are they going to give Germany the ability to use those same nukes? For example, someone is attacking Poland. Is Germany now allowed to use French nukes to defend the European continent? Obviously, that would share the nuclear umbrella. That would be an added deterrent because you may say, I kind of doubt that France will be using their nuclear weapons. They have kind of been weak and wishy-washy in the past. But if you know that it's Germany that might strike, you're like, well, I don't want to take that risk, so I better back off. So you can see for France, like, yeah, we want to have Germany on our side because Germany might be a more feared nation than we are. And then Britain, what if someone will attack one of, for example, Northern Ireland, or will attack invade in Scotland, or will start, or Russia has been threatening to shoot missiles on London? Is the nuclear umbrella of the United Kingdom big enough deterrent, or do we need a bigger deterrent than that? So the UK said, let's also discuss that. But this discussion has been going on for decades. The second German defense minister, Franz Josef Strauß, he wrote a book, The Grand Design, where he talked about the nuclear umbrella of Britain and France, and he said Germany needs to have a part in that because the American nukes are not going to be enough. But it's not until now that, as America is withdrawing, that France and Britain are saying, you have a point, we are willing to now share those nuclear weapons. So that's different from all of what we have seen in the past few decades. It's the willingness of Britain and France to say, Germany, we trust you now, potentially with knowing where our nuclear weapons are, what we are capable of, and even perhaps sharing you to use those same nuclear weapons.
And of course, doing this helps remove some of the power and control the United States has on Germany. And the fact that Germany relies on American nuclear weapons, you know, these, in theory, they're American nuclear weapons. America has a key, but they would go on German planes with German pilots. But they've been sitting on German air bases for decades. So, okay, like Germany has a lot of control over these nuclear weapons, but in theory, Donald Trump could say tomorrow, hey, we want the nuclear weapons back. And Germany's got a kind of a big problem. It's either got to entirely give up its nuclear umbrella or risk this massive confrontation with the United States over nuclear weapons that it really doesn't want. So the fact that America can withdraw its nuclear umbrella at any point gives them a lot of leverage. If there's an alternative nuclear umbrella, then that leverage is greatly reduced. I thought international politics from the German Council on Foreign Relations made a really interesting point, though, where they pointed out that the British and French nuclear umbrella doesn't do everything that the American nuclear umbrella does. The American nuclear umbrella is big. That's one part of it, that they could just come back at an attacker with a whole lot more nuclear firepower than even Britain and France combined can. But Britain and France combining does get closer to just the sheer level of volume that you could get with the United States. But they also point out that there's various different functions of American nuclear weapons that Britain and France don't have. One of them is a very small nuclear bomb. Russia has very small nuclear weapons. The big fear is that a very small nuclear weapon, something that's not going to destroy a city, but something that might be very advantageous to use on the battlefield, something that maybe could destroy a very large chunk of the Ukrainian military if they're massed somewhere, would be more usable. And if Britain, if Europe doesn't have their own version, then the fear is that Russia uses one of these. And now Europe faces this dilemma of, well, if we respond with just a conventional attack as deterrence, well, that makes us look weak because Russia has used a nuclear bomb and we haven't responded in kind. Is that then going to embolden Russia and make them use bigger and bigger nuclear weapons? But if the only kind of item on the table is that the massive nuclear bombs that we're more familiar with, well, now Europe is escalating and using a much bigger nuclear bomb. And is that pushing the world closer towards war? So Europe feels like, well, we need small nuclear weapons to respond in case another nation like Russia or someone else uses a small nuclear weapon. And the only place they really have those is from the United States. France has some smaller ones than Britain. They're still classed as tactical nuclear weapons, and they're designed to act as kind of a warning shot in this fashion. They're still over 300 times more powerful than the America's variable yield bombs are on their lowest setting. So what this article in International Politic, the point that they made that I thought was really interesting, is Europe needs to fix the holes in its umbrella and expand the size of its umbrella. If it does that very openly and publicly, there's a good chance that America will then withdraw its nuclear umbrella. Hey, you're trying to be independent from us. Why should we help you? So they've got to do that quietly. And that is where we are right now. So International Politic made this point. They wrote, the dilemma is to keep the US in Europe's deterrent while developing alternatives without giving Washington the impression that it's no longer needed. They need to quietly build the capability and only when it's in place announce, hey, America, we don't need you anymore. So I thought that was a fascinating background to some of this discussion and some of France, Britain working together, and even shows perhaps that if Germany does go start working on their own nuclear bomb, maybe they'll go for the low end, for the very small nuclear weapons to cover that gap. It also makes it easier for them to justify some kind of nuclear program, I guess, if you're developing small bombs. But I mean, really, in the public consciousness, small bombs, big bombs, there's not a massive difference. But I thought that was a very interesting part of this.
Yeah, just to add on that, like, America has technical nuclear weapons, and part of the discussion now is that Germany will start helping to fund Britain or France, mostly France, and the discussion is right now to help them advance their nuclear weapons. So Germany obviously has more money than France. It has a larger economy, the largest economy in Europe, and they have the largest defense spending. But France has the nuclear arsenal. So if Germany now gives the resources and perhaps also some of the engineers and scientists, could they advance the nuclear umbrella of France more to later then expand it over all of Europe?
Well, this point on technology, I think, is an interesting one too, because, again, in the popular consciousness, we're at this point, I think, where we still think about nuclear weapons in the same way that we did in the 50s and 60s. That they are some of the most technologically advanced and difficult to make things on the planet. When they're actually 60, 70, 80-year-old pieces of technology. Like, they're not as hard to make. You could go back to the 50s and 60s, and okay, yeah, it was only the most developed nations and only the most brilliant scientists and scientific teams that could make these things. Now we live in a world where a lot of countries have very advanced civilian nuclear infrastructure. Germany did until a few years ago. France is one of the world leaders on nuclear infrastructure. Like, this is not the cutting edge technology it once was. And developing nuclear bombs isn't the challenge that it used to be. This is something that can be done much more easily. So, and potentially much more quietly. Now, I think a country would still probably want to do some tests. I certainly wouldn't be comfortable relying on my survival as a nation on a weapon I hadn't tested. But the bar for getting nuclear weapons is a whole lot lower. And I think it's still a big taboo. But now you're looking at, say, Iran wants the bomb. Saudi Arabia's been talking about. I think it just takes a few more countries. You may be someone like Saudi Arabia getting the bomb. And that taboo is dramatically lowered. And you could see countries sprint towards nuclear weapons, I think, tremendously quickly. A lot of these countries, they have the know-how. They have the ingredients. It's not going to take very much for them to put things together. And really, if I were charting the future survival of my country, and maybe I'm not a nuclear weapon state, I would have all the ingredients assembled, like set aside somewhere, so I could build and test one in an afternoon if necessary. I mean, that's kind of Japan. It's almost an open secret that they could develop a nuclear weapon within 6 months. There's a lot of countries in that position.
Yeah, and the secrecy part, and Germany agreed after World War II to not build nuclear weapons on their ground, and the second defense minister said, yes, we agreed that we don't build nuclear weapons on our ground, which raised then the question in debate, are you building nuclear weapons on someone else's ground? And later it turned out that they're working with Argentina, I believe, and Brazil, and they were helping some of their nuclear program, and that raised then questions. Is Germany really committed to not having nuclear weapons? No, we don't know how all this developed in the end, but just to have that research part done already is a massive step to then having nuclear weapons. Just recently, American scientists said Germany has some of the most advanced uranium enrichment facilities. And yes, they do, and they used it for electricity, and they could switch them on again. So they have all that capability, and they have the military technology to deliver those nuclear weapons. So they are quite prepared for that.
So this brings back to something you brought up earlier. Britain is trusting Germany, or moving in the direction of trusting Germany with the most destructive weapons in history. I mean, we are looking at real movement towards a European nuclear deterrent. So Britain signed this treaty with France, where the two of them are going to work together on their nuclear deterrence. And I think already that's a massive level of trust. It means potentially sharing with France the location, the schedule of nuclear submarines. Britain already, we kind of struggle to keep our nuclear submarines well-maintained enough to have one at sea at all times. That's the theory, is that there's always a nuclear submarine at sea, because that way, if you wipe out the UK, you don't know where the submarine is, and it's going to get you back and wipe you out. And so you don't wipe out the UK. That's the theory. In practice, we struggle to have one submarine at sea, at least one at sea at all times. You could certainly see when now we've got this agreement with France, you reach the position where we kind of say, okay, well, we need to do some maintenance. Let's not have a submarine at sea right now. And we'll rely on France to look after us, and maybe vice versa. But there was already a whole lot of trust to kind of take the survival of your nation and put that in the hands of another nation. Then to bring in Germany with that, well, that's something Mr. Armstrong talked about. That's something that we've talked about at the trumpet for a long, long time. And I wanted to kind of get into that directly, because you alluded to, okay, well, Britain, America, they're World War II enemies. And I think the way a lot of people look at this is that was 80 years ago. That's kind of three generations. We're at the point now where, for most people, they didn't fight in World War II. Their parents didn't fight in World War II. Their grandparents didn't fight in World War II. It was their great grandparents that you have to go back to. And alliances shift. Throughout the early 1800s, 1810, all the way up to 1814, Britain was at war with France. Then you get into the 1840s, 1850s, we're allied with France against Russia in the Crimean War. Like, this is just what happens. You're enemies with one nation. A couple of generations later, you're allied with them as the balance of power shifts and you have a new enemy that you're more worried about. This is what we've had happen with Germany. We were against Germany in World War II. Then Russia became the big enemy. So while we allied with Germany, we're still worried about Russia. We're not sure about relying on the United States. So how concerned does... Why does Britain need to be concerned about relying on Germany?
Well, you bring up a very good point of history, because Britain has been the broker. They have been like ensuring the balance of power on the European continent. If France was rising, they were allying with the people that were fighting France. If Germany was rising, they were allying with the people that were fighting against Germany. Well, right now, Britain is not doing that job anymore. Germany is rising and becoming the dominant power, and Britain is the one supporting it. So this is a different level of trust. It's not France against Germany, where Britain is saying, I support the one over the other, that no one is dominating, and that no one is able to attack us, that no one is able to be a threat to us. This time, Britain is becoming a subordinate force to a European conglomerate dominated by Germany. So from that perspective, this is a whole different ballgame, where Britain is not in a position anymore to be that one that ensures the balance of power. And yes, it is true, there's not a great risk that a war will break out between France and Germany, because they are closely allied together. Which brings us to the question of, is Britain at a risk of being conquered now that they are outside of the European Union, by the European Union, by a German-led dominant power? Now, most people would say Germany has changed. And you mentioned they are allied now. Now you have to see, Germany has a different mindset than Britain. Britain did not care about conquering the European continent at the time. They were just wanting to ensure that there's a balance of power. Germany had ambition to conquer Britain in both World War I and World War II. I mentioned the vengeance weapons earlier. The word vengeance is a strong word in Germany, but they are feeling betrayed by Britain when they were being bombed, they were being attacked, and it's still in memories there. The cities don't look the same anymore. And children have been talking to their grandparents. And hatred carries on from generation to generation. And you do see it in the German press that there is hatred, especially if you go to the French newspapers, and you do see it growing up in a country that was once bombed by another country that did lose not just one world war, but two world wars. And yes, these people have not fought in that world war, but Rheinmetall was part of it. And the CEOs know that history, some cover it up. So it's still very much alive in Germany. And of course, we don't just base this on history and on current affairs. We are much more guided by the sure word of Bible prophecy. And there are numerous prophecies that specifically say that Assyria, modern-day Germany, will attack Britain. And it specifically says that Britain will see Germany as their allies, as their lovers, as it says in Ezekiel and in Jeremiah. We even have a clip from Mr. Gerald Fluey, our editor-in-chief, where he talks about this history where the British leaders used to oppose German domination. Then they gave that up and they became allies with Germany. And he warned about that, if you can play that clip.
Well, anyhow, they managed to get Margaret Thatcher out. She was the only one that really saw that Europe was being led by Germany, the opposite of what they planned. And she told them about it and kept reminding of that. And she said, it will never work. In Jeremiah 4 and verse 30, God talks about lovers will be the ones who inflict great suffering upon us if we don't see God's view and make some changes. That's what your Bible says. Ezekiel 23 has a powerful story about that. Here's what it says in Jeremiah 4 and verse 30. Well, I'll just give you the last part of it. Your lovers will despise you and they will seek your life. In other words, they're not our friends, not the kind of people you want to give nuclear bombs to. And how is that really something that any other nation would do? Not in most cases, surely. Ezekiel 23 talks about the same things happening, but notice the end result. And they shall recompense your lewdness upon you, and you shall bear the sins of your idols, and you shall know that I am the Eternal. God is going to get our attention, and we're going to get to know God with some suffering if we don't repent and turn ourselves to God. We're now forsaking Him.
Yes. So there are very specific prophecies there that the lovers, the people you trust, the people you think that were your allies, even though they were your enemies before, will be the ones betraying you. In fact, they despise you. They hate you. You think they love you, but they actually hate you. You don't understand the feeling that they have. You don't understand the feeling of revenge that is simmering in so many Germans. You don't understand what they're doing when they're building a military. It's not for defense purposes. That's what the Bible is warning about. And then a prophecy in Hosea says that Britain will come to the point where they're so weak because America is out of the picture that they will trust in Germany instead of trusting in God. And that's an important part of this prophecy. You have to understand the United States and Britain and prophecy, a book that Mr. Armstrong wrote, identifying Britain's history as the ancient people of Israel, the tribe of Ephraim. They had a history of God. At one point, they were being taught by God, and they have chosen not to trust Him. That's why they went into captivity, and into Assyrian captivity. And these prophecies are about to repeat themselves unless Britain heeds that warning. God always sends a warning before something happens. In the pages of the Bible and this literature of our editor-in-chief, Mr. Flui, who points to that prophecies, warns Britain today that a betrayal is coming unless they wake up to it.
I think those are some really good points that you make there. I think the point about, well, it's not just Germany, it's about Britain's whole approach to Europe has changed. It used to be about keeping Europe divided so that there's no one power that dominates Europe, because if one power does, they can threaten Britain. That's a critical shift that we see happening here. And it's not just about, okay, it's a changing world and there's bigger enemies that we need to worry about. It is a lack of ambition, much more than that, a broken will, where Britain is just quite happy to kind of subordinate itself to Europe. And I think you really put so much of it really well. And I think one thing that maybe I could add to some of that is I do think we live in a bit of an unreality at the moment. Like one thing I find fascinating from studying history is at how many points in history people thought that they had solved war and that they had kind of brought about perpetual peace. And maybe not like absolute peace, but that future wars would be small affairs that wouldn't really affect them too much. You know, this crops up again and again in kind of, say, more recent history. You've got in the 18th century, the 1700s, a lot of people thought, hey, we've got modern armies now. We've kind of got warfare down to a science. Wars might still happen, but they're going to be kind of maneuvers, and generals will maneuver around each other, and a losing general will kind of understand, okay, I'm in a bad position and I'm beaten, and he won't put up the fight. And so casualty numbers in future wars are going to be very low. And then you got the Napoleonic Wars, where casualties were off the charts. In the run-up to World War I, very famously, you have Norman Angell publishing The Great Illusion, arguing that war could never happen again, or certainly a major European war. I think published in 1909, there were various different editions, but he argues it's just unthinkable. It couldn't happen because we're so interdependent. We've got so much world trade. You'd lose so much money. It would be so destructive in terms of human life. it's just not going to happen. You will never get another major European war. And it was massively popular, and that was people's worldview. And I think that was why so many people were surprised by World War One. And so we've been here many, many times before. And I think a big part of the reason why Britain, America, we're so willing to share our nuclear weapons, not with just with Germany, but with anyone, is we kind of have settled into this unreality that war is kind of unthinkable to us. And we do that, you know, evolution. Mr. Armstrong talked about how evolution really is at the foundation of modern education. I think there's an evolutionary thinking just ingrained in so many of us where, yeah, we're just always evolving. We are more evolved and better people than the people of the 1930s or the people of the 1910s or the people of the 1800s, and certainly than those that 2,000, 3,000 years ago. You know, we have iPhones and laptops and satellites, and we're sophisticated. And all of that scientific advancements means that almost morally and spiritually we're better. And that is not true. Human nature is fundamentally evil. That's something Mr. Armstrong came back to again and again. And we have settled on this unreality, you know, and we're living in a great illusion right now. And so, sure, yeah, we'll share nuclear weapons. And you know, these stories that we've been talking about have all happened over the last few weeks, and they've not been front headline stories. They've not been what the newspapers are interested in, because they're not what their readers are interested in. I think the other aspect that you pointed to that is really fascinating is this, like, how thoroughly Germany's government was infiltrated with Nazis after World War II. Like, that is not even debatable anymore. There have been, just about every German department has published evidence, has published these massive reports, like multi-volume, really thick reports that say, okay, yeah, immediately after World War II, we claimed that our department, that all the people working for our department only reluctantly kind of went along with Adolf Hitler, and that we didn't have any real Nazis. And actually, we slowed down Adolf Hitler, and we claimed that our department slowed down Adolf Hitler during World War II. Yeah, that was wrong. Actually, our department was full of enthusiastic Nazis who loved what Hitler was doing, and they stayed in their jobs into the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and beyond. Like, that is well-established fact. And nobody then goes and says, well, what does that mean now? And that's something that you mentioned recently in an article. I think you were writing about the new Germany's new ambassador to the Vatican, that he's the head of, or the former head of Germany's Secret Service, and now he's moved on to be the ambassador to the Vatican. Like, Germany's Secret Service was deleting its World War II history and covering up its kind of Nazi infiltration in the immediate decades after World War II. They were covering that up in, I think, was it 2012, they were destroying files. So, you know, there's a modern rot there. So I think you point to lots of good reasons why Britain is foolish to do this. But ultimately, it really does come down to the Bible and to Bible prophecy. And this is why Mr. Armstrong warned about it. This is why Mr. Flurry has warned about this. I mean, yet it all does tie together, because the Bible gives you the overview of European history. It describes this Holy Roman Empire that rises and falls throughout history. And Revelation 17 talks about it being led by a woman. Daniel chapter 8 talks about it being controlled by this little horn. It's different symbolisms, but it's describing an empire led by a deceived church. And the book of Revelation talks about it being led by or controlled by the dragon. Daniel chapter 7, I think I said Daniel 8 earlier, but I meant Daniel 7, it talks about this little horn destroying the saints and speaking great things against God. And this is an empire that Satan repeatedly uses to try and fight against God's plan for mankind. And then, because God is, you know, it's Satan's world, but God is more powerful than Satan, again and again, this empire ends up being used ultimately for God's purposes. But it's there fighting against God's church. It's there fighting against what God is doing in the world. And God intended to use Britain and America, these descendants of modern Israel, to set an example of God's way of life. They had a history with God. He poured out all of these blessings. And then if they'd have lived God's way of life, those blessings would have continued. And it would have been a wonderful message that God would have used to bring more people and to show more people, well, God's way of life and his law, far from being onerous and a burden, leads to joy and peace and happiness. But, you know, Britain, America, we didn't do that. Instead, we've become really some of the most morally depraved and corrupt nations. We're the ones really that are kind of foisting and pushing countries around the world to embrace perversion and LGBT pride parades. And, you know, we've pushed a lot of that into Europe. We've done the opposite of what God wanted. But those blessings are then still a powerful lesson. They show that you can have all of this material wealth and all of these material blessings and a wonderful start. And if you disobey God's law, it still all ends horribly. It's not about having material wealth that matters. It's about obedience. So we're still teaching that lesson. But this Holy Roman Empire plays this role throughout history in fighting against what God is working and what God is doing there and fighting against Israel. And now Britain and America, we're here empowering that, embracing that, exactly the way that the Bible prophesied and Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Flurry talked about for years.
The point you made about the evolutionary thinking that we get better and better, right now we're learning more and more that that's not true. With Russia's war in Ukraine, with the Hamas Holocaust on Jewish people, the beheading of children, little babies. And they went there and they did it with their own hands. But these days, as you mentioned also, we have new technologies that make killing so much easier and you are much more detached from it. People say, I wouldn't kill, but millions of people kill on their video screen all the time. And I grew up in Germany and a lot of them do it. They go out and they're in the little living room and they shoot people for hours and hours and they see the blood gushing out. What difference is it now to lead a drone to do that same? Just recently, a Russian soldier took a drone and targeted a toddler and killed that little toddler. If you have a child, you know how those parents feel when that happens. But those soldiers, they are detached from that reality. Their mind has been altered to not care about it. And Paul wrote to Timothy saying, evildoers will wax worse and worse. It's not getting better. It's only going to get better when God intervenes in world affairs to change the heart of man, to really bring peace. But till then, it won't get better. And with time, mankind will learn that lesson the hard way.
Well, thank you very much for that, Joshua. We will have an article that the two of us are working on this story that will be in the next Trumpet Print magazine. For now, if you go to our website, thetrumpet.com, if you click on the Europe section, you kind of scroll down and we have a lot of different sections. You can find several articles that we've written on this subject. Rheinmetall's Infiltration of Britain, I think, was one of the most recent, published just this week. The UK and Germany signed new treaty in US absence. Then I had one, is Britain preparing to share nuclear bombs with Germany? So all of these will kind of go into that upcoming story. But also the United States and Britain in Prophecy is a great place, an essential place, really, to get that overview of what God is doing here, why it is happening. I mean, that book unlocks Bible prophecy. That book unlocks an understanding of world events, and we'd be very happy to send that to you. You can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com, and you know, we're very happy to ship that anywhere in the world. And we can put links to all of those in our show notes as well. Thank you very much for joining me today, Joshua.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much to George Haddad for engineering and production. Thank you very much to you, the listener. If you have any questions, any comments, feel free to get in touch at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. Please do feel free to like, subscribe, leave a comment on Rumble or YouTube, wherever you're watching us. And we'll be back on Friday with our regular Week in Review show. Until then, keep watching your world.